Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Bill Ayers. Bill is a distinguished University of Chicago professor of education and a senior university scholar. He's retired. He founded the Small Schools Workshop and Center for Youth and Society. He's a longtime social justice advocate. We'll talk about world and national issues that are on Bill's mind. There are so many of them at home and abroad. They sure keep me busy. Bill, I welcome you to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, it's great having you on. I don't know if I have a Chicago guest on. Yesterday I had a guest from Italy. I might have a guest from anywhere, but it's great to have somebody close by. So I welcome you.
Yeah, Chicago's the center of the universe, so you ought to do it more often. But that's a Chicago chauvinist talking. So.
Oh, well, I've lived here for over 40 years, Bill. I was born in Boston, born and bred, but I've lived here since the end of the 1960s. So Chicago very, very much is my home. It would be nice if we had a good administration running the city. We seem to go from bad to worse.
Yeah, that's why my solution to that is to get rid of the mayor altogether. Why do we need a mayor? When I ask people that, they think I'm kidding, and when I press it, they say, "Well, who would sign the bills, and who would?" Yeah, exactly. Nobody knows what the mayor does, but we all are certain we need one. I'm not so sure.
I think it's a wonderful idea, especially when we have mayors like the two Dailies and Rahm Emanuel. I call him what he is. He's a former White House chief of staff, complicit in the war crimes of the Obama administration. He's also a guy who made millions of dollars the old-fashioned way on Wall Street by stealing it. He's an unindicted war criminal.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. And on top of that, you can add the title the murder mayor, because he's presiding over the worst kind of epidemic of gun violence, imaginable, and doing nothing about it. So except closing schools, which is another item in the indictment.
Oh, absolutely. The rage to privatize, Bill. I first go to charter schools, and then I think eventually move from that to privatization, get rid of public education, this multi-century system that educated people, educated me. I grew up in inner city Boston from a modest family. I had nothing going for me, but I went to schools that taught. There was decorum. Teachers taught. It got me into two top schools when they were affordable. That's all gone now, unless you're rich. You simply don't have the things that I had back in the 1940s, 1950s, and it's because of the system we have that prioritizes profits over things that really are the most important for most people, and it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, you couldn't be more right, but I mean, the other way to think about it is that you're right about the privatization. It's not just schools. It's the entire public space is being privatized, and one of the important things about the struggle around closing schools right now is that it is actually the focus of, is there such a thing as the public? Is there such a need as, the community need or the public social need? And this is where the fight is coming down in Chicago right now. It's about schools, because the mayor and his people just announced they're going to close 54 schools and 61 school buildings. And this is in a situation where the schools aren't all that good anyway, and they're now moving out to a more intense Jim Crow kind of system or apartheid kind of system of schooling. It's outrageous. 85% of the people affected by these closings are African American from poor neighborhoods, and they're being abandoned once again.
Yeah, it's so true, Bill. And it began under Mayor Daley. Oh, for a number
well,
of years.
Daley and Arnie Duncan. I mean, and one of the
Arnie
things
Duncan,
that
yeah.
is worth noting, and I note this all the time, is that, in the school struggles at least, is that, in a democracy where we take as an article of faith that every human being is of incalculable value, and the implications of that are vast, not only for policy, but for curriculum and teaching, but But you would think that we would come to the conclusion that whatever the most privileged people have for their children should be the standard that we as a community want for all of our children. And so you look at Mayor Emanuel, Mayor Daley, Barack Obama and his family, Arne Duncan, all chose the laboratory schools at the University of Chicago. And frankly, my kids went to the lab school as well. What do the kids find at the lab school? They find teachers who are not only respected, but unionized. They find a curriculum that's forward-looking. They find class size capped at 15. They find, you know, they find a lot of those kind of well-resourced classrooms. And if it's good enough for those kids, why is it not good enough for the kids on the west side of Chicago? And that's a question I think that we have to pursue very vigorously, and I do. And in fact, I don't know if you were aware or if your listeners are aware of the banning of Persepolis last week. Were you?
Oh, no.
You follow that? You know the book Persepolis? It's a graphic novel memoir about the Iranian Revolution by a brilliant young Iranian girl. Well, she's not young anymore, but when she was 10, the Iranian Revolution took place. And she writes a memoir in graphic form. It's a comic book. And it's called Persepolis, which is the ancient name for Iran. And this book is phenomenal book, really brilliantly done. And it's won all kinds of prizes. And it's been banned in two places, Iran and Saudi Arabia have banned this book. And last week, the superintendent of Chicago schools, under a complaint from a single parent, banned it in the Chicago public schools. And, of course, you can imagine there's been pandemonium and pushback. But I did what I always do, which is I called the lab school, because that's where the privileged go. And I got a hold of the librarian and said, how many do you have the book Persepolis? And she said, we have 8 copies, 2 in French, which is the original language that it was written in. And I said, is it widely read? And she said, it's required reading in 7th grade. So once again, Rahm Emanuel's kids get real literature and real art, and the kids at Lane Tech get test prep. And that's ghetto education at its worst, and that's what we are fighting here in Chicago.
Boy, we sure do need to fight it, Bill. And I wrote an article which I titled, what was my title? I write so many, I forget my title. But basically, it was Hollywood-style history, Hollywood reinventing history.
Oh,
I,
sure. Yeah.
I included in my article the Academy Award-winning film Argo that completely distorted and suppressed the Iranian Revolution, the meaning of it, what happened. It took a side issue, and it reported it inaccurately, and it won an Academy Award, Bill, for lying, for absolutely
exactly.
Lying. The movie was a piece of trash.
It's a great example of what you're describing, you know, the false history. And one of the ways that the kind of project of American exceptionalism, the project of American militarism projected all over the world, one of the ways that they get away with that is that we actually don't know our history very well. We don't know our geography very well. And certainly 9/11 was a wake-up call to many people about that. But I don't know if you saw that National Geographic did a survey of 18 to 25-year-old American kids, gave them a blank world map. 80% couldn't find Iraq. 80% couldn't find Palestine, Israel. Something like 40% couldn't find Great Britain. And an astonishing 10% couldn't find the United States on a blank world map. So people all over the world say, well, the problem with Americans, they don't know who they are and they don't know where they are. We have a false sense of history, and we have a narcissistic, myopic sense of geography, and that allows us to allow our politicians and the political class to get away with murder.
It sure is true, Bill. The only time Americans learn history is when America goes to war, and they get enough stories on TV, the usual TV networks. Otherwise, as you say, they have no idea where Iraq is or Afghanistan. They may not even know it's a country until it's identified as a U.S. target. It shows how deplorable the U.S. education system is, and it wasn't that way when you and I went to school.
No, it's true. It's a backward system. I mean, I wouldn't get too nostalgic for the good old days, because there were problems then too. And I think that, you know, you think about when I went to school, schools were strictly segregated racially.
Oh, yeah.
It's unfortunately still true, but it was legally segregated back when I went to school. The history of slavery that was told was a very benign and distorted history, the history of the decimation of Native Americans. But one of the great things about the upheavals of the of those days, of the 60s and 70s, and the civil rights movement in particular, and all that flowed from that, the women's movement and so on, is that one of the first projects of all of those movements was to reclaim the history. And so we learned about Native struggles, and we learned about slave uprisings, and we learned about women's history and queer history. And these were great, great things. Now they still exist, and so we all benefit from them. But it's time for another, for more upheavals and to locate ourselves in the world as a people among people, not as in the deathless phrase the State Department, the indispensable nation. Madeleine Albright invented that, the indispensable nation. We're not the indispensable nation. We're just a power nation that does a lot of mischief around the world.
Bill, I certainly remember the things that the warts on the U.S. system, to go back to the time when I was much younger, homophobia and the racial discrimination. I lived in a mixed neighborhood, so it really didn't affect me in my schools, but I remember the stuff that went on and the reports, the stuff that I read and learned about, and of course Martin Luther King and the civil rights advocates that fought for change and the legislation we got in the 1960s. It didn't really, it helped things modestly, and very sadly, all the benefits gained back then, there weren't enough. I quoted in an article I wrote, it's been some time now, that a modern civil rights leader said, everything gained back then has been lost, and in some respects it may be worse, because you don't see the overt stuff, but beneath the surface you see horrors. You see the U.S. prison system, two-thirds of those in it are blacks and Latinos. Well, the prison system was a shadow back then of what it is now. It's only been in the last few decades that it expanded exponentially, and poor people and people of color are the ones that fill it. Most of them are for nonviolent crimes. At most, they should have been misdemeanors. They don't belong in prison, but they're there, and some of them can be there a very long time. This is racism.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that is, I think, a challenge for all of us is to, we all know what we would have done a generation before or three generations before. The question is, what are we going to do now? And the racial nightmare that is right at the center of the American experience, there was a period when fighting the slave trade was where all the, kind of progressive anti-racist energy went. And then there was a period when abolition, and then there was a period when fighting for civil rights. And I would say there are many civil rights issues today, but two of them that stand out are the anti-prison movement, the prison abolition movement, which is hugely important because prison is the new Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander called it. The new Jim Crow exists in prisons. And one of the things but I think is important for all of us to remember, is that after the abolition of slavery, all the black code laws in the South basically reinstated a kind of serfdom through a prison system in the South. Well, that's what we're now seeing nationwide. So we have a huge gulag, and hardly anywhere you look, you won't see a prison with the overrepresentation of black and Latino men, as you say. And it's really kind of, it's kind of shocking and stunning to think about that there are more black men today under the criminal justice shadow than there were slaves in 1850. I mean, that's an amazing, amazing thing. 6 million under correctional supervision. More than were in Stalin's gulag. I mean, and something like 50,000 American men are held in isolation every day. This is a cruelty. This is, and it falls along racial lines. So I just, I couldn't agree with you more. This is our new challenge. And every generation faces challenges, and this is one that we have to face now.
Absolutely, Bill. I've quoted from Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. It really is important, and I wanted to make a point of it in articles that I've written. I did it several times, and indeed, what's going on is absolutely horrific. One of the first articles I ever wrote, I began writing very, very late in my life, Bill. My former working life was in small family business, and I never imagined I'd be doing what I'm doing now. But one of my first articles I wrote was on the U.S. prison system. and I called it the U.S. I remember this title. I called it the U.S. Gulag prison system, subtitled
right.
"The Shame of the Nation." And it really, it's a horrific story that too few people know about, and it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. It's a horror.
I mean,
it's an absolute horror.
Anywhere you go in the developed world, anywhere you go, people know about our prison system. 2.5 million, almost 2.5 million of our fellow citizens under lock and key. And if I say to my students, for example, at the University of Illinois at Chicago, 1 mile from here, there are 9,000 black men living in cages. They're like, what? Really? Yeah, really, really. Cook County Prison. And it's outrageous, the crimes that people get arrested for and the racialized nature of it. So, yes, it's a growing and serious problem. And it really bodes poorly for the future when you have this kind of criminal justice system standing next to an educational system in collapse. And so here are these black kids in Chicago facing school closings. Something like 30,000 students are going to be directly affected, 100,000 indirectly. And what's their future? I mean, the only kind of certainty they have is that they will face the criminal justice system at some point. And that's a dreadful statement about our future.
It really is a dreadful statement, and it's hard to believe. My memory is pretty good going back, because there were wonderful things that I can reflect on, Bill. And thinking back to those times, I never could have imagined that we would come to where we are today. And I see it getting worse and worse. And it simply doesn't matter whether you've got Democrats or Republicans in charge. Both parties follow the same system. The only difference is in the rhetoric and the way people perceive them. But you can get somebody like Obama, who's a smooth-talking con man, who after all the harm that he's caused, I've said this so many times, after all the harm he's been involved in, half the country still supports him. It shows how little people know, how out of touch they are, the immense harm that affects so many people so grievously, with domestic policies, repression at home, foreign wars, eroding social services. And one of the first things he did when he came into office, he gave an interview to the Washington Post. He said Medicare is unaffordable. We have to lock billions of dollars off of it. I think he didn't say much of anything about Social Security, but he wants to hit Social Security. He wants to hit Medicare. He wants to hit Medicaid, and this is his mandate. And the public rhetoric belies what he's doing behind the scenes. I mean, this is awful stuff.
Well, you know, the corruption of the Democratic Party, if anybody ever needed any evidence of it. I mean, the corruption is so profound, and that you're right. I mean, they agree, the Republicans and the Democrats, it's one kind of party with two blocks or two blockheads, because they all agree on war and conquest. They all agree. None of them are putting forward a plan to close the Pentagon or at least shut down all the foreign military bases. And nobody has a plan to punish Wall Street. We're back to too big to fail without missing a beat. So everybody agrees on that. But the corruption of the Democratic Party is so obvious in certain things. For example, something over 90% of Americans want some restrictions on assault weapons, and the Democrats won't pass it. I mean, they can't respond even to something as obvious and overwhelmingly popular as that. So, but let me take it to a different level, this point you're making, which is, I think that we have to keep reminding ourselves that we don't have a king in this country or a queen. We actually have, at least theoretically, a democracy where we can elect our leaders. But much more important than that, since we don't have a king, I think we spend way too much time, all of us, and certainly progressives and people on the left, we spend way too much time looking at the seats of power we have no access to. And that includes the Pentagon and Wall Street and the White House and the Congress. Those are the centers of power we don't have access to. access to. The centers of power we do have access to and absolute access, the workplace, the school, the classroom, the street, the neighborhood. And this is where most of our energy should go, because this is where we can actually make a difference. One of my favorite moments in the 2008 campaign was when Obama, you know, the weird narrative that went on during that campaign, the right wing looked at Obama and said, oh, he's a dangerous leftist who pals around with terrorists and is a secret Muslim socialist. And the left wing looked at Obama and said, oh, I think he's winking at me. But he wasn't winking. He said, I'm a middle of the road, pragmatic, compromising politician. That's his record in Illinois. That's who he was. He's also a fantastically nice person and compassionate. And those things aren't contradictory. You can be a nice person and still be all those other things. But the most telling moment in the campaign was when someone asked Obama, who would Martin Luther King support? And his response was, King wouldn't support any of us. He'd be in the streets building a movement for justice. That is absolutely true. And the reason it's so important is it tells us what we should do. If you think back, you talked about civil rights legislation. You think back, Lyndon Johnson was a cracker from Texas. He was not part of the Black Freedom Movement, but he responded to a movement on the ground by passing the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. FDR was a patrician New Yorker. He wasn't part of the labor movement. And Abraham Lincoln was never part of an abolitionist party. But those three presidents who are remembered for those progressive accomplishments could never have moved if it hadn't been for profound, powerful, earth-shaking movements on the ground. That's our job. We build the movements. We don't worry too much about, you know, power that we can't affect except through movement building. And that's where I spend most of my time.
Well, Bill, that's a key point that I stress all the time. I say it on air. I say it in articles. If people think they can go to the polls and throw out the bums, all they're going to get are new bums. The elections in America really accomplish nothing. It's popular activism that gets results. And sometimes it can get politicians who don't want to do things to actually do them because the groundswell just sweeps them along. It's a lot tougher today, I think, than it was decades earlier, Bill. We don't have
I'm not sure that it's tougher. I mean, the thing that it always is tough when you're in the middle of it. I mean, looking back on the civil rights movement, it all seems like a narrative made to happen. But if you lived through it and you watched Martin Luther King, for example, evolve every year to become much more profoundly radical, much more profoundly popular, and at the same time, much more isolated from the seats of formal power. When King was killed, he had an approval rating in the polls lower than George W. Bush when he left office.
I mean, I didn't know that.
It was unbelievable, because what King was doing, and I urge my students all the time to read the speeches and sermons of King between 65 and 68, when his evolution was so profoundly in place, and he was talking about the three evils, racism, militarism, and materialism, consumerism. And when he was making the link between racial justice, global justice, war and peace, and economic justice, that's when his radicalism really reached fruition. And he had an analysis of this country that is not represented in the prayer breakfast and the kind of mythological king that the country celebrates. But I think that that's the king to get back a hold of. And the fact is that it only looks like a narrative arc that's coherent when you look back on it. In the middle of 1965 or 1963, for example, everybody thought the civil rights movement was dead in 1963. It took a lot of organizing and a lot of events to happen to make it, you know, revitalize itself. So when you're living in the middle of history, everything seems confusing and uncertain. We all know where we'd be if we were alive in 1840. We'd be abolitionists. We'd all march with King today. We'd all be on the side of gay rights today. That's not the problem. The problem is to look at the world today and say, what am I missing? What kind of a justice struggles are bubbling up that we can begin to connect? And I think it's everywhere. I think the fight for immigrant rights, the fight for queer rights, the fight for women's rights. I see things all over this fight to save the public education system. These things have the potential to unleash an absolute prairie fire.
Well, I certainly agree, Bill. And it's hindsight is absolutely clairvoyant.
Yeah, absolutely. You always know, you know, that's the problem. You always know where you'd be. But you mentioned elections and the fraudulence of elections. I mean, depending on how things are, but you say to anybody that it cost Barack Obama $500 million to get elected the first time and $1 billion the second time. People look at that anywhere in the world, or maybe 40 years from now, somebody's grandchildren will say to them, gosh, you call that democracy? What's that got to do with democracy if you can buy an election like that? If a guy like Newt Gingrich can have one backer and become a credible candidate because he's got millions and millions of dollars, that is not democracy, and it's nothing close to democracy. So the fight continues, and there are so many levels. My students often say to me, you know, I can't do everything. What do you think I should do? And I say, you know, in a world as out of balance as this one, you don't have to do everything. You can do something, do one thing, and then connect that one thing to other things. And that's how a movement gets built.
Well, that's exactly right. People ask me that question also. I get emails on it, and I say, everybody can do something. You know, I do what I do. I write. I do media work. You don't have to write. You don't have to do this, but everybody can do something. The first thing is get informed enough. Anybody connected online can do it so easily, Bill. I say, people, if they just spend 15 minutes a day turning off their TV set and finding reliable websites that give good information, they would know enough to know we have very serious problems, and maybe that would light a fire under them to want to do something. So understanding is the first thing, and then deciding that only people at the grassroots can make a difference. If you think politicians are going to do it, you're living in a dream world. It doesn't happen. It never happens unless they're ignited, motivated by people who won't accept anything less. People power is real.
Absolutely, and the for me, the rhythm of activism is the same as the rhythm of good citizenship or responsible engagement with your life, and that is simply the first point is exactly what you said. Open your eyes. You can't make moral judgments. You can't make activist judgments if you're not aware. And opening your eyes isn't something you do once and then put on automatic pilot because your ideology tells you what the answers are. It's something you have to do actively every day and in every way. So opening your eyes, paying attention, that's step one. And then step two is being astonished. And you have to allow yourself a sense of astonishment, both astonished at the joy and beauty and love and humanity that's all around us, and also astonishment at the cruelty and unnecessary suffering and ridiculous kind of short-sighted insanity that passes for public policy. So we should be both overjoyed, ecstatic, and outraged at what we see. And then the third step is you have to do something. You have to act. And the fourth step, and this is equally important, is you have to rethink. If all you do is act, then you get lost in your activism. You have to ask yourself, did I teach? Did I learn? Did I grow? Did I bring others along? And then you have to start over. Open your eyes, be astonished, act, doubt. And if you keep doing that for a lifetime, that's the rhythm of activism. It's not exactly a formula, but it gives you a little outline of how you want to get up in the morning with, you know, as I often say to myself, you know, I get up every morning certain that today I'll overthrow capitalism, and then I go to bed disappointed, but I get up the next morning absolutely re-energized and ready to go again.
Well, I feel the same way, Bill. None of us are going to change the world on our own, and it certainly doesn't happen quickly. There's a famous quote from I.F. Stone. It's a very long one, and I can't repeat it verbatim, but I used it in a couple of articles I wrote where he said essentially that the most important battles people wage are the ones they'll never win. But if they do it and people who follow them do it, then one day somebody will win because of the work others did before them. Something
That's
to that
beautiful.
Effect. I think
yeah.
It's so true. It takes a long time to win these great struggles. And what we're doing today, we may change nothing. But maybe if even we waited a generation from now, if humanity can survive a generation, Bill, that very much is an open question. But if it can, maybe a generation from now, what people do today can bring the change that people today want. And that's the foundation
exactly.
that needs to be built.
Well, as a lifelong teacher, I've often thought, you know, I may not change the world, but I may help change some of the people who will change the world. Or another way of saying, of making your point that I think is important for activists of all ages to remember is that our activism isn't always built on a calculus of victory. It's often built on a calculus on a more existential basis, and that is a calculus of measuring my own humanity, of trying to figure out my own identity. So I'll never forget going down, it must be 15 years ago now, I had maybe longer than that, I went down to protest the first execution in Illinois when the death penalty was reinstated. I had no belief that we would win anything by doing that. I just was so outraged and disgusted by the unanimity in the media about how wonderful it was that I went down to be opposed to it. And that was we were all alone, 12 of us.
That's
and
a great example, later, Bill. That's a great example. The music means we need to take a short break. Hold that thought, and we'll come right back.
Okay, I'll get right back. Thank you.
Welcome back. On with Bill Ayers. Talking about many issues, lots of domestic ones. Bill, I want to let you finish up your thought on the death penalty. That's an issue I've addressed a few times, and the fact that former governor, Illinois Governor Ryan, took a giant step toward getting rid of it, and now it is off the books in Illinois and in a good many other states around the country. It's an appalling law, the death penalty, but it's only one of so many things.
It is, but, you know, the point I was making before we took the break is that, you know, when I went down to protest the killing of John Wayne Gacy, it wasn't because either that I thought John Wayne Gacy was, you know, a cause to support. I thought the killing of him by the state of Illinois was an atrocity, and the fact that the public media was so excited about it and so on. So I drove down there, again, not with the idea that we would defeat the death penalty, but the idea that I would at least plant my flag in opposition to the death penalty, as I planted my flag in so many different fields. And so I drove down there. My wife and I had three little kids at home at the time, and so we drew straws. I won. I drove down there with a little sign that said, "Thou shalt not kill." When I got there, there were thousands of young people having basically a rock and roll beer party outside the prison, so excited that Gacy was going to be killed. I made my way to the front of the prison, and there were 12 people, a group of elderly nuns and a couple of lawyers and me. And we sat there singing, you know, freedom songs, and then he was executed, and then we went home. Very depressing evening, partly to see these young people so enthusiastic about this. But 2 years later, one of the lawyers who was standing in that circle won the first wrongful conviction case. And a few years after that, with a lot of mobilizing and a lot of popular movement, Illinois led the nation in turning against the death penalty. Now, Illinois was the least likely place for that to happen, and I'm not saying that my going down there had anything to do with it, but what it does show is that people, when their eyes are open, they can change, and people can become part of the solution. But we have to all kind of plant our flags where we can and then connect the issues. This was a wonderful, wonderful movement in Illinois against the barbarity of the death penalty. And it was only one step. Those people who led that struggle in Illinois are now very much on to the opposing the mass incarceration, and they're doing it in a great, smart way. So, yeah, I think this is the lesson for all of us.
Oh, it really is, Bill. Another issue that I spend a great deal of time on is what I like to call neoliberal harshness, the idea that social benefits are eroding and bailing out bankers comes first, taking care of other corporate favorites, the situation in crisis. And in Cyprus, I mean, in Cyprus in the last 4 days, I've written daily articles on it. I'm trying to keep up with it. Usually I'll write an article and I'll get it out the next day, but the situation in Cyprus is in flux. Events are fast moving, and when it's that type of condition, I feel that what I write I need to get out the same day, because if I don't, what I write may be stale and I'll have to completely rewrite it. So I wrote my fourth article this morning. I got it out today. There'll be a meeting going on in Brussels tonight. That's where the so-called Troika officials will be. Well, there'll be 17 finance ministers from the 17 Eurozone countries. And I imagine the Troika, the IMF, the ECB, and the EU, there'll be representatives, certainly IMF and ECB representatives will be there. And the president of Cyprus is going hat in hand to give these so-and-sos what they want, which is basically ripping off ordinary people. Outrageous things were proposed, including assessing bank accounts above $100,000, 20%, stealing 20% of the money in people's bank accounts over $100,000, and 4% if the accounts are under $100,000, plus all the other force-fed austerity that's going on. And, of course, this went on in Greece and in Spain, across Europe. It's happening in America. It's a big issue. It's an issue that needs to really be hammered on all the time.
Right. It's absolutely true. I lived in Cyprus off and on the last couple of years. I was teaching there at the university and doing an oral history project. So I'm watching it with a lot of interest. And the anger in Cyprus is just palpable, because the sense that Germany, once again, with a new set of tools, is wreaking havoc on Europe is absolutely profound. So it's a terrible time, and it's an exciting time. And one of the things is that, and you know this very well, but you know, this old Charles Dickens notion that it's the worst of times and it's the best of times. We have to be aware as progressives that crises are really moments of opportunity. It's a moment to reframe the discussion and reframe the debate. And one of the, you know, one of the losses of the last few years has been that the economic crisis here has not led to a kind of a mass upheaval against it, but it's never too late. And I really do believe that people can learn from these crises. One of the things you were talking earlier about the Obama administration, one of the things I think is an outrage is that when they came into office in 2008, 2009, you know, they immediately announced that they weren't going to prosecute the people who brought us into Iraq, weren't going to investigate.
Exactly.
That was that was giving everything away. The fact is that we were lied into this billion-dollar boondoggle where thousands of Americans were killed and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghanis, and Cheney reaped an unbelievable windfall profit, and these guys, these kind of mediocre, backward people who actually, you know, robbed us blind, get off scot-free. And there's a huge message there about justice and about social justice. And once again, it's the haplessness of the Democrats that should be very revealing for people about what we need to do.
Well, indeed. I think Obama went on television and announced this. I know I wrote about it and I quoted him. I think it was on ABC's Sunday program, whatever name the program is, but I think he went on the Sunday program and he said something like, "We're looking forward, not backwards."
Exactly. That's exactly what he said. And what an outrage. I mean, it was really a terrible, terrible decision. So, you know, we're living with that, but it's, again, these are just things that we need to note as we move forward and name the issues that need to be organized on right now.
Absolutely, Bill. And straight away in office in 2009, one of the first things he did was issue an executive order ordering Guantanamo closed. Well, Guantanamo was still open. There were plans to expand it. There were still 166 people there. Nearly all of them are innocent, possibly. All of them are innocent. And let's prove otherwise. I honestly don't believe a single human being in that prison is guilty of anything. I do know, and I've written about it, that people were picked up for bounty. Anybody somebody said was a Taliban member, they got so many thousands of dollars. Anybody they said was an Al-Qaeda member, they got many more thousands of dollars. You didn't have to prove it.
Right.
You just had to say it.
No, you're absolutely right. This has been proven that this was, this is how they got these people, and they're all pictured as if they're, you know, the worst of the worst. But the fact is, many of them are folks who were just turned in for money. They were just sold to the Americans.
And of course, they were all tortured, Bill. And if people are tortured brutally enough, they'll end up saying anything. So, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed,
absolutely.
I don't believe he had anything to do with 9/11 in any way, shape, or form. But they tortured him brutally at Guantanamo and before he got to Guantanamo at one or more of the prisons in Afghanistan. I remember writing that he was waterboarded alone, something like 180 odd times. But they did a lot more to him, and I wrote about what was known, what came out. I mean, horrific stuff. No human being could tolerate that. Just to get the pain to stop, he's going to say anything they want. He'll sign anything they want him to sign. So at some point, he's going to go on trial. They're going to accuse him of 9/11. He had nothing to do with it. Right. And they'll probably end up hanging him.
Right. Unbelievable.
And he won't get a civil trial. He'll get a military commission trial, which is a kangaroo trial with a military
right.
judge. It's guilty by accusation. I mean, he is absolutely, he has no possibility for justice.
No, absolutely. And this is something, again, you know, we can ignore it at our peril because in the end it comes back. And this kind of behavior is criminal behavior. You know, the drones are criminal behavior recognized by international law as crimes. And we have to come to terms with it if we want to live as a nation among nations. There's no question about it.
We have a very serious human rights abuser, and there are so many examples that prove it. The torture prisons around the world, the Gulag prison system at home, the repressive state laws. I've written about so many of them under Bush, under Obama, the idea that Obama could have a kill list, Bill, and order anybody on his authority murdered, including U.S.
citizens. Outrageous.
With no way,
yeah,
because he says so.
Yeah, and I don't even want to make a big deal out of the U.S. citizen point because every human being, it's human rights law, it's international law, that everyone has a right to the kinds of protections that this violates. And so it's not just that he can do it to American citizens, the fact that he can do it to, you know, a Somali citizen or a, you know, a Saudi Arabian citizen is equally outrageous. And so no American exceptionalism. This is crimes against humanity. It should be stopped and it should be prosecuted. I mean, one of the things that is so obvious all over the world, again, is that, you know, you have somebody like Charles Taylor brought before the International Criminal Court. What about Dick Cheney? What about Donald Rumsfeld? Their crimes were equal to or surpassed the crimes of the people they have on trial there. So this is something, again, that we need to press for as Americans. We need to demand that our own government be held to an international standard that's recognized by everybody.
Oh, absolutely, Bill. I mean, a human being is a human being, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about a U.S. citizen or anybody else. But people can be brutalized. It's official U.S. policy. It happens all the time. It happens multiple ways. I mean, they can kill them on the ground. They can kill them by drones. They can kill them by wars, by disease, by deprivation. I wrote about the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. It is without question one of history's great crimes. I read an appalling editorial in the Wall Street Journal. It was an extremely long one. I thought about writing an article on it. I'd already written about Iraq, so I decided not to. But it was an absolutely appalling editorial. It was filled with one lie after another, truth turned on its head egregiously, and making an apology right. for that war. That war was an illegal war of aggression. Iraq is still a war zone. People are suffering horrendously, all kinds of ways, from hunger, displacement, poverty, unemployment. There are car bombs going on all the time. People are dying. None of this gets any resonance in the U.S. media. And the Wall Street Journal Murdoch's paper had the audacity to call it a war that needed to be fought. And they also have op-eds by people who do the same thing.
Right, right. Unbelievable.
And, of course, Afghanistan is still going on. Proxy wars going on in Yemen, in Somalia, in other places. The Syria war is raging. Washington planned that war years ago. I say it absolutely. This is Washington's war. The idea is to get rid of an independent leader and replace that person with a pro-Western puppet. That's the idea in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in all the wars that America wages, and the thought that the possibility that there could be a war against Iran. I mean, it's, I've had a number of interviews on it, and I've written about it. I think the war in Syria is madness, and a war with Iran would be a madness writ large. It could literally ignite a regional war, and it possibly could go global. And don't leaders of countries think about these things? Not just America, but the NATO partners, the regional allies. The regional allies especially, Bill, they live in that area. Do they want to risk a war that'll spill over their borders and cause them harm if they go along with these policies that they absolutely should oppose?
It's outrageous. It really is. You're exactly right. Unbelievable.
But again, too few people understand this stuff, Bill, and you certainly don't get information on it through the U.S. media. I have a favorite phrase for the U.S. media, the major media. I call them media scoundrels. I can't think of a better way to describe them.
Well, it's true.
They literally turn truth on
their head. One of the very sad things about the commercial media, the bought media, is that, you know, there was a Pentagon study done in 1975 about the coverage of the Vietnam War, and it wasn't as heroic as the media likes to portray it, but it was at least the case that American journalists who were not radicals, they had the right to wander around an American battlefield, and a few of them told the truth about what they saw, and when they told the truth, you know, the lid came off, and that was a huge kind of hugely important, and the Pentagon recognized it and did a study, and they concluded that no American reporter should be allowed access to an American battlefield ever again. And since 1975, no American reporter has been granted access to an American battlefield, and that's the reality that we live with. So,
that's something that the media should be outraged about.
Yeah.
The embedded reporters. Yeah, you remember what Studs Terkel, the phrase that he used. He called them in bed with journalists.
Oh, yeah. He said, I'm hard of hearing. Did they say in bed with? And the answer is yes, they're in bed with the military. Absolutely.
Well, that's the way it is, and that's the news you get on TV and read in the New York Times and the rest of it, and you simply don't get the facts as they needed to be. We got them in the Vietnam era, at least enough of them, and I remember reading, I didn't hear him say it, but I remember reading that Lyndon Johnson accused Walter Cronkite of America losing the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and I remember Walter Cronkite interviewing Nguyen Cao Ky, and calling him the George Washington of his country, and this was a fascist. You know, so Cronkite, the Times, all of them went along with the war when they raised the simplest questions. They were, you know, pilloried by the political establishment, but the fact is that it was people like Francis Fitzgerald and Michael Hearn and others who simply told the truth about what they saw. And then the visuals, you know, the fact that we saw actually what war looks like, and there's nothing glorious or pretty about it. And that's essential for people to be informed and to understand what the project actually is. And most Americans are horrified when they see images like My Lai, which, as John Kerry said when he came back and testified before the Senate, we commit war crimes in Vietnam every day, not as a matter of choice, but as a matter of policy. And that was true. And he's tried to live that down ever since, but that was one of the best things he ever did.
Well, I quoted
to tell the truth about that war.
I quoted him verbatim. That was another John Kerry of a bygone era, the new Secretary of State. I mean, his words were very, very dramatic. He made no bones about them. And he won medals in Vietnam. He threw them away. He threw them, I forget where
with
he
a lot of other vets. Yeah, we got a lot of other vets. They
with
threw
a lot
them
of
back.
Vets.
And that was a very important moment. And then John Kerry made the ridiculous miscalculation of running for president by trying to run away from that moment rather than embracing that moment. That was his best moment. And anyone who lived through those moments knows that was the best, you know, of the vets coming back and telling the truth and then, you know, taking the consequences for that. And when he ran for president, he ran away from that. That was a mistake, and he paid.
He sure did pay. Even though I think the evidence shows that the election wasn't exactly on the up and up, it certainly was in 2000 when Al Gore won and the Supreme Court stopped the popular vote in Florida and then decided that a 5-4 decision, they annulled the popular vote and put George Bush in the White House. He was kept there in 2004. He certainly wasn't reelected. Every time I used his name, I'm not certain if I did it every time, but I did it a number of times. I simply could not put a capital P on the word president when talking about George Bush.
It was stolen twice, and there's no question about it. So I think that's another example. It's partly the money. It's partly the corruption of money, but it's also partly the suppression of the vote and then the kind of literal stealing of votes that went on in both of those. It goes on regularly, you know. So, yeah, it's something that needs to be fought and exposed and opposed.
Well, indeed so. I wrote about other politicians who stole their way into office, including Lyndon Johnson, who I think it was a race for Congress at the time, not the Senate.
Yeah, but in that one district in Texas, yeah.
He stole enough votes to get into the Congress, and the rest, as they say, is history. It's been a long time since I wrote about that, Bill, and I don't remember the details, but I think right up to the cusp of the election, his opponent had a very sizable lead, and yet Lyndon Johnson won.
That's right. Amazing, huh?
Oh, amazing indeed. And to go from that to the White House shows the kind of system we have, Bill. There's something very, very wrong, and unless a way is found to fix this thing, I don't know if you or I will ever see it in our lifetime, but maybe what we do will pave the way for others to do it if humanity survives. That's always a tagline I have to put on it.
Yeah, because of course, because it's hanging in the balance, right?
It's hanging in the balance. With Doug Dowd on yesterday, he made the point that this is very much an issue. He said to the effect that if we wage another major war, it'll be the last one because there'll be nothing after that.
That's right. That's exactly right. Where was Doug? In Italy?
In Italy. He's in Italy now. 94
okay.
years old, still going strong. Slow down a little
bit.
I asked him if he was still teaching. He said he stopped not too long ago. It was a long train ride from where he lived to where he taught, and he was only doing it part-time. But he really began slowing down, and the tough trip, he said, it also was a little bit of a dangerous one, so he stopped. But imagine doing it all the way up to age 94.
No, it's astonishing. It really is. Yeah, it's lovely, really.
But he's still writing. He's still doing books. He's got another article coming out before long, he said. He's got me on his distribution list, so I see the stuff that he writes, and I like to quote him every now and then. If I can only do half of what he's doing, if I ever get close to that age, who knows? You take it day by day.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
But that would be wonderful. I did tell him on air that what I'm doing is really a tonic. It energizes me, and it helps keep me young. So maybe it'll give me a longer life than I would have otherwise.
Exactly.
I just can't see sitting around doing what other people do, whether it's going fishing or watching television. Or I don't know, what retired people do? if you can't stay
well, active. I'm retired, and I'm in the streets as often as possible. So it's possible to retire from your formal job and find your work increasingly rewarding, and that's how I feel about my work.
Well, that's exactly the way I feel, Bill. I stumbled into it by accident, but it was a glorious accident, and I just can't imagine doing anything but what I'm doing now. I look forward every day to getting up and doing more, and I feel that even as one person, I'm making a small difference. Maybe I can motivate others to do something. Bill, we're just about out of time. A quick final thought.
Well, I wanted to tell you, speaking of books, that I have a book coming out in the fall called Public Enemy, about the 2008 campaign and all the things that happened leading up to that and leading out of that. So take a look at it. It comes out in the fall, Beacon Press, Public Enemy.
Will you come back on this program and discuss it?
I would love it to do it.
Cue me when the book is out. I'll get you scheduled, and we'll get you back, and we'll talk about the book. I love talking about good books on the program. And
very
I'll send you a reminder email. Bill, thank you very much.
appreciate your having me. Thanks
oh, it was
so
great
much.
Having you on. We'll be on okay. next Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We'll be on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.